Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The United States leads the world in mass shootings. They are happening with alarming frequency and to devastating effect. After every mass shooting, we ask a simple question for which there is no simple answer. Why? Almost all the shooters are young and male. All use guns to carry out their misbegotten plans, and yet there have been few attempts to examine our gun laws until recently, following the shootings in Dayton and El Paso. In the aftermath of those tragedies, even President Trump said he believed we could strengthen the laws on background checks. But then, almost immediately, he seemed to pivot away from guns and laws to mental health.
We must reform our mental health laws to better identify mentally disturbed individuals who may commit acts of violence and make sure those people not only get treatment, but when necessary, involuntary confinement. Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun.
That is an assertion the president has made more than once, and it keeps coming up during his campaign rallies.
We are working very hard to make sure we keep guns out of the hands of insane people and those who are mentally sick and shouldn't have guns. But people have to remember, however, that there is a mental illness problem that has to be dealt with. It's not the gun that pulls the trigger. It's the person holding the gun.
The president is correct. We do need to focus more of our resources on mental illness, but the connection between mental illness and gun violence is tenuous at best. While it is true it is the person holding the gun that pulls the trigger, it is difficult to draw a solid line between that person and his gun and mental illness. Only 3 to 4% of gun deaths involve someone with a mental illness, and more often than not, they are the victims. So where is this connection coming from? What is the impact of making that incorrect connection, and where should our focus be? For that discussion, we're joined by Dr. Sharif Solomon, a forensic psychiatrist at Atrium Health. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Kathy Rogers is Executive Director of Mental Health America of the Central Carolinas, which focuses on advocacy and education around mental health issues. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Justin Perry is the owner and therapist at Perry Counseling, Healing, and Recovery, where he specializes in treating individuals who struggle with shame, insecurity, and personal relationships, which we'll talk about because that seems to play a role in some of these shootings as well. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can even watch us this morning on Facebook Live. So, Dr. Solomon, before we talk about statistics and all that good stuff, let me get a question out of the way that a lot of people immediately want to ask. Wouldn't you have to be mentally ill to pick up a weapon and walk into a Walmart and start shooting innocent people?
Well, the short answer is no. However, many people instinctively feel that somebody has to be mentally ill to kill a large number of people, but people unfortunately kill for many reasons. I've evaluated hundreds of people accused of crimes, many accused of homicides, and there are many underlying reasons that are unrelated to mental illness, such as financial reasons. People kill out of anger, people kill out of jealousy, people kill out of rage, people kill for revenge because they feel aggrieved. So there are many reasons that are unrelated to severe mental illness that lead to killing.
But as I prepped for this show yesterday, this is where I really had trouble coming to grips with this, with understanding it, because we all get angry in our lives. We all have grievances in our lives. But we don't go into a Walmart and kill people. We don't walk down the street and just pull out a gun and start shooting people walking down the sidewalk because we're angry that we didn't get that promotion at work or somebody slighted us and stole our parking place. Some people do. Some people just snap. Isn't that a mental problem?
Well, I would first just disagree with a slight part of the question when you said that some people snap. Surely that happens, but generally speaking, what you see with these mass shootings is a phase of very careful planning. Some people who previously didn't own weapons will acquire weapons, learn how to use them. So these are usually very carefully planned attacks. There are individuals with certain character traits, such as extremely narcissistic people who can't often cope with feeling slighted. And these aren't usually minor slights, but somebody who feels severely aggrieved, like they've been wronged by society or a specific individual or a specific group of individuals, and they have a personality structure such that they can't let go of that grievance. Is that a mental problem? Very broadly defined, you can find symptoms of mental illness, but what we are discussing are severe mental diseases of the sort that would warrant inpatient treatment. And of that group, very, very few are mass shooters. And looking at it from the perspective of reducing violence, if you look at all gun violence, only a very small proportion, as you cited, 3-4%, is committed by people with mental illness. In fact, for your audience, an interesting statistic is that you are 15 times more likely in a given year to be struck by lightning than to be killed by a patient with schizophrenia using a gun.
So let me switch this up a little bit, because I've watched Kathy Rogers over here with Mental Health America of the Central Carolinas nodding in agreement with you vigorously over here on some of the things that you said. So let me turn the question around. Why would any sane person do what these shooters have done? I know he's explained grievance, he's explained anger, etc. But a sane person, fully in control of oneself, could they not put those emotions in control and into perspective and take that anger out on, I don't know, the sofa cushions? I mean, why would you go into a Walmart and shoot people?
So I feel like Dr. Salomon answered that question.
I can't understand it. I don't understand it.
I do feel like there are life events that cause us to lose control. One day, perhaps it's a divorce or losing one's job.
But isn't that what you would call momentary insanity? I mean, isn't there a defense in the legal?
It could be an emotional crisis, but I'll defer to.
And I think that we need a definition of mental illness then.
Well, I think we're talking more about chronic mental illness the danger that I see is that we're lumping every time there is a mass shooting, it seems convenient to blame it on mental illness when we're not exploring other.
Because we'd rather blame it on that than what the real root cause is in some cases.
Well, I would say maybe hatred is not a mental illness.
I was going to put this later in the program. Hatred is not a mental illness. But the kind of hatred that leads to your picking up a gun and killing people or getting into a car in Charlottesville and running over people, that's not crazy?
Well, I think
I don't mean to use crazy. That's a bad word in your job.
Well, to some degree, people want it to be because there was – I read an op-ed recently in the New York Times by a psychiatrist by the name of Richard Friedman with the title that mass shooters may not be that different than you and I. Mm-hmm. I'm paraphrasing the title. But the idea is that we look at something that seems so heinous and we want to put it in the category of other.
Right.
That person is dramatically different. They're ill. They have a severe disease, which in the vast majority of cases is not true. These are human emotions that are taken to an extreme. Again, it has to do often with personality structure. Sometimes it has to do with extreme political or religious beliefs that cause one to commit acts of terror. Mm-hmm. But mental illness is rarely the culprit.
Justin Perry, you want to chime in on that?
I've been waiting very patiently, Mike.
I could tell.
So I think there's a lot of things that are at play. And so I'm gonna go with one of the elephants in the room. You know, when we say, why is it that we want to blame it on mental illness, even when we described who's doing it, you know, it is males, but more importantly, it's white males. And so when we talk about, when ISIS happened, we didn't think about mental illness. When people talk about Chicago and the violence in the inner cities, they don't talk about mental illness, even though there is a lot of unrecognized PTSD and everything else that's happening there. The reality is that in this nation, we would think, wow, there's no way that this young white kid who looks like my kid could be capable of something so severe. When the reality is when you look at the history of our country, this is not a new phenomenon. Whether we're talking about indigenous genocide, whether we're talking about lynchings and everything else, you know, this is, you know, whether we're talking about the bombings that happened in Alabama with the little girls dying, this is actually as American as apple pie, but we continue to avoid that conversation because it's uncomfortable. Mm. It's much easier to say that there's some kind of random bug that this person has. Going further, when we talk about men, again, I often talk about the root of toxic masculinity. And so, you know, masculinity in itself has a lot of great traits. You know, again, we were bonding over the fact of both having 6-year-old and 3-year-old kids, you know, and so
you're pointing to Dr. Solomon.
Yes, yes, exactly. And you know, and so caring for your family is a great masculine trait. You know, there's a healthy level of competitiveness, there's a healthy level of assertiveness. But when we talk about the toxic aspect, what we're talking about are individuals who are not taught healthy ways to deal with their emotions, yeah, who are taught to be completely in their head. And I think what happens, I'll finish this, Mike, really quickly.
Sorry.
So when we talk about anger, mm-hmm, anger is the only emotion that a lot of these young men are allowed to have. But what a lot of us in our field know is that anger is a secondary emotion that's often shielding something like shame, like fear, like anxiety, that's more vulnerable. And so we don't want to appear vulnerable, so I can feel strong by shooting people versus dealing with the fact that I'm embarrassed and ashamed that I'm not living up to what I think I'm supposed to be doing.
We're going to come back to that because that's an interesting it's not a theory. It's probably a fact, but, I mean, it's an interesting point of view that you don't hear articulated very often. Aside from temporary insanity, which we hear as a legal defense, a lot of these young men who cause these mass shootings end up either dead at the end of the mass shooting because they kill themselves, mm-hmm, or they are taken out by law enforcement in an attempt to stop the carnage. So how do we know that a lot – because most of them – that happens to most of them. How do we know they weren't mentally unstable or mentally ill when they did these acts? Because they're not around to examine.
Well, let me first kind of just disagree slightly with you, Mike, on this notion of temporary insanity.
Mm-hmm.
There is obviously a legal defense of insanity, and people are found not guilty by reason of insanity. But the standard, and it varies from state to state, but broadly speaking, it's that one has a severe mental disease that causes them to not know the wrongfulness of their act.
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break, and I'll come back and get an answer to the second part of that question, which is about how we know these folks who end up dead at the end of these mass shooting incidents were not mentally ill. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. The political world has its attention on the presidential race, but local elections coming up will have a bigger impact on the day-to-day lives of Charlottesians. 7 Democrats are on the ballot for city council at large in next month's primary. So join Charlotte Talks for a live forum with the candidates Wednesday, August 28th at 7 p.m. at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. And send your questions for the candidates in advance to charlottetalks@wfae.org. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the intersection of mental illness and guns. Is it a connection? Are the people who are perpetrators of mass shootings mentally ill, or are they not? And professionals say not necessarily. And it is very difficult to draw a line between mental illness and the use of guns to solve problems or the use of gun in a mass shooting situation. We're here with Dr. Sharif Solomon, forensic psychiatrist at Atrium Health, Kathy Rogers, executive director of Mental Health America of the Central Carolinas, and Justin Perry, therapist at Perry Counseling, Healing, and Recovery. I want to get an answer to my first question, then we'll come to you, Justin. Dr. Solomon, the fact that a lot of these perpetrators of mass violence end up dead at the end, how do we know they weren't dealing with mental health issues if we don't have a chance to examine them, talk to them?
Sure. It makes it, obviously, not having an examination makes it difficult to know for certain whether someone was suffering from mental disease. However, bringing it back to severe mental diseases, when somebody has a severe mental disease such as schizophrenia, you usually see some deterioration in their functioning. You often have observable symptoms. Certainly there are millions of people who suffer in silence, who have depression.
But can't these things strike quickly? And I mean, and this gets into the difference between physical illness and mental illness. Today I don't have a cold. Tomorrow I might, depending upon who I meet today. So today I'm mentally healthy. Tomorrow will I necessarily be mentally healthy? Or is that something that has to build up over time?
There are certainly conditions that can happen quickly. Generally, with schizophrenia and severe psychotic illnesses, meaning those illnesses that are characterized by a loss of touch with reality, you typically see a building over time. However, going back to mass shooters, many of these actions are carefully planned out over a period of weeks or months in many cases. So they're not... There isn't often this notion of people just snapping.
So I'm talking to three clinical professionals here who have clinical definitions of what is and what is not mental illness. And in the break, Justin Perry, you asked me, do I think the people committing all these murders in Chicago, for that matter, in Charlotte, are mentally ill? And I said, no, I don't. I don't think it has anything to do with the color of your skin, but I do think that that's a different situation than somebody picking up a rifle and walking into a crowded theater or a classroom and just starting to shoot. Whether you plan it out for months or years in advance, whether you start buying weapons and lots of ammunition over a period of time, or whether I walk out this door at the show at the end of the show today and buy a gun and ammunition and do it tomorrow, I don't see a difference. I do see that that's a mental – I see that as a mental illness, and lots of people would, but not the shootings that we see on the street.
Sure, and I'm glad that we're having this on air, because I think it's a blind spot that you have that's not unique to you.
Okay.
I think that, again, in our country, we have always humanized white folks and treated indigenous black and brown folks as savages. That's actually the language that our nation has had. And so what happens is when we see this mass shooter, we see them through a lens of, I could see that as me. I could see that as my husband. I could see that as my son. But I'll give a very simple question. There is many women with mental illness as there are men. Why are there not women committing mass shootings? You don't have to answer that. That's why it's not mental illness. Go. Let me give some more time. So, again, I think we really have to deconstruct. When we talk about the term white supremacy, everybody thinks of actual Nazis and things of that nature. But I think it's important to understand that it's an ideology and it's a structure, and they both are actually interconnected in this. So the ideology, again, this nation was built. I'm going to finish, Mike.
No.
You know, to help white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male landowners. So, again, it is race, it's ethnicity. I'm going to finish, Mike. It's religion and it's class. And the reason why this matters is because what happens, unfortunately, for a lot of white males is that the philosophy is the world is your oyster and I am supposed to succeed. and which works well when it's working, but when you crash, it is such a hard fall. And that's part of this explosion. There's an entitlement. And when we talk about the feeling of being aggrieved, that's part of the challenge. Any rejection seems very huge, whereas other folks who are used to being marginalized are used to dealing with the rejection.
That's what I was going to move you toward. The world is your oyster, because you have said that you believe that teaching white boys that the world is their oyster, one, helps them to excel on the one hand, but it also creates an entitlement situation and a struggle with empathy that can be self-destructive. Is that why we keep saying, well, this never happened in the 1960s. These mass shootings didn't happen in the 1950s. When you think about it through the lens that you just gave us to use, it's because it was a completely white-oriented society. Now young males are struggling to find their place in that society. Is that what you're saying? White males.
I'm saying one, I'll actually say it did happen. It happened in trees and other ways in the 50s and the 60s, because when I talk to my grandparents, it's a different ballgame. I will say this. The shifting demographics certainly. So, again, when we talk about El Paso, I mean, the kid actually spoke it. This is why it's definitely not insanity.
Okay.
He literally was talking about, again, all these phrases like the Browning of America and everything like that are scary phrases for folks who feel like I am being replaced or I'm losing my position in this world. And so how do I go about getting it back? Well, if I can't negotiate it back, I have to take it by force. And so, again, this is calculated. This is strategic. This is not random. And so I think, unfortunately, we are missocializing men, period. But I think white boys and white men, unfortunately, are given such a narrow example of what a successful life is. I need to major in business, make a lot of money, and if I don't do that, I'm failing. And again, and I say this to a lot of people that I treat, you know, so again, I actually can have empathy for my clients. And I have these young boys who come in that are interested in other stuff, but they tell me, I have to major in business because I've got to figure out how to provide a life for a wife that she's accustomed to. And I'm like, you're 16 years old. And so what happens when that kid is not on track to do those things? Hmm. And it's like, well, if I can't do that, then I'm a failure. All of a sudden, you have folks who feel like there's no outlet.
But then that leads to depression and anxiety and feelings of low self-worth. Isn't that a mental problem for some people?
Well, depression and anxiety certainly are mental health.
And I have both of those.
Yes.
Because it kind of all comes together at some point. But I know that people say that blaming these mass shootings on people with mental illness when they do not have mental illness is harmful to those who do have.
It does have consequences. When we paint a broad brush, whenever there's a mass shooting, that it is mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
We know that one in five of us are dealing with a mental health diagnosis, but many, there's still that stigma that surrounds mental illness. And when we go straight to that as the blame for gun violence in this country, we're further stigmatizing and keeping those people that should be getting help from getting help because they feel like they're going to be called a monster or crazy or, you know, these labels that we put on people. What we should be focused on is getting people the treatment that they need, getting early access to mental health care, normalizing mental health so that we're not using this detrimental language.
The FBI at one point was looking into the motives for El Paso and Dayton. I'm sure they still are, and specifically in the Dayton case. And they uncovered evidence that the 24-year-old suspect there in Dayton, young, white, and male, was exploring violent ideologies, something that is not unusual, it seems, among these people who commit these mass acts of violence. If you're attracted to violent thoughts or groups who are interested in violence against others, whoever those others are, for whatever the reason is to not like those other people, doesn't that make you in some way, help me out here, doctor, mentally ill? I'm not attracted to that.
Sure. Not necessarily. However, I want to distinguish between having some symptoms of mental illness, such as, for example, feeling depressed for a brief period that doesn't necessarily meet the 2-week criteria for major depressive disorder, or having some anxiety. Obviously, symptoms of mental illness are fairly broad and fairly common. I also want to kind of jump off of and slightly disagree with something Justin said. I wouldn't define this as necessarily being uniquely American. I think it's uniquely human. I mean, there have been atrocities committed throughout human history using a variety of means. You said earlier that it didn't happen in the 60s. Well, does the name Charles Whitman mean anything? The clock tower shooter in Austin?
But that was one. Yes, but I remember that incident, and that incident was horrific and shocking, and it stopped the country in its tracks because it was so unusual.
Right. Well, there was also the Bath School disaster in Michigan in 1927, using bombs rather than guns, that killed over 30 school children. And the perpetrator ultimately died of suicide, and he was aggrieved because his wife was ill with tuberculosis. He had lost in a local election to, I believe, the school board, but I'm not certain. And he left a scrawled message that said, "Criminals are made, not born." So there have been these atrocities committed for various reasons throughout human history that are independent of, and again, I'm narrowing this to severe mental diseases.
Right.
And I was going to say, and just for the record, I didn't say it's uniquely American. What I'm saying is this is actually a part of our fabric.
Sure.
And so I was one other thing that I want to think we haven't mentioned, I think it's very important, is that domestic violence is actually more linked to mass shootings than mental illness. And I think there's a reason we won't have that conversation, because there's way more men committing domestic violence that haven't gone in and gotten a diagnosis of mental health treatment who would all of a sudden have gun restrictions. And that's the part of the equation we don't want to talk about.
Why is domestic violence a mental problem and mass shootings are not?
I didn't say it was a mental problem. I said that it's...
So they needed to go in and get mental...
No, I said... Let me slow it down. Mm-hmm. All right. So domestic violence is more linked with mass shootings than mental illness. The reason we will not talk about that is because if we use domestic violence as an indicator for folks having restricted gun access, then there would be a lot larger part of the population who does not seek mental health treatment who all of a sudden may have restrictions on their guns.
John, from our website comments, there are mental health issues in every country. Why is gun violence so much more prevalent in the United States? It can't just be a mental issue.
I would say the prevalence of guns in our country is something that we have to talk about. One thing we haven't said is 22,000 Americans die every year from suicide by a firearm. Almost 1,000 of those are children who take their lives. So that has to be part of the conversation.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, in part of my conversation around white males and everything like that, the overwhelming majority of people dying from suicide by gun are white males. And so, again, when I talk about this and I say that it's all of these things that wrap into it, that's part of the conversation.
And in fact, when we say that people with mental illness are more likely to be victims of gun violence and not the perpetrators, is it because they use a gun to take their own life? Is that why that's the case?
Well, that's part of it, but the larger issue is that many times they're victimized in the community. Mm-hmm. They're abused, exploited, marginalized, and stigmatized, which is a part of, I think, all of our concern with placing a focus on mental illness, is that, first of all, it only targets a very small fraction of gun violence, about 3%, leaving the 97% unaddressed. And second, by stigmatizing individuals with mental illness, you worsen the problem with access. You make it less likely that people will seek treatment.
And that's also this idea that victims are often the people who are mentally ill. That's where these red flag laws also come into play. And I know that your organization, the Mental Health America of the Central Carolinas, and the whole organization nationwide is in favor of these red flag laws, because they would allow police and family members who believe that somebody is a danger to themselves or others to have their firearms removed at least temporarily.
And, that's but controversial. Not just someone with a mental illness. Extreme risk protection orders are for anyone, you know, Justin mentioned domestic violence or losing your job or showing signs that you may do harm to yourself and to others, that there needs to be due process, you know, so that guns can't just be removed. But you know, it's not a bad thing if a gun is not within someone's reach, if they're thinking about taking their lives or doing harm to others.
So does, if a mass shooter is not necessarily mentally ill, are there symptoms? There are no symptoms that are happening prior to the event that people could spot. And so doesn't that neuter the impact of red flag laws?
No, there's a difference between symptoms and red flags. Mm-hmm. So, for example, someone who's not mentally ill can communicate threats, can say, you know, I'm so mad at you that I'm going to do X, Y, Z, or I'm going to come back with a gun. They can show signs of increasing anger, mm-hmm. Threatening behavior, a sudden obsession with violent ideology. So there can be red flags that may or may not be symptoms of mental illness, and also symptoms do not necessarily equal or rise to the level mm-hmm. of a diagnosable mental illness, let alone a severe one.
And I was going to say also, and again, one of the behaviors also to look at, again, I'm keep coming back to this domestic violence thing, is a choking incident. Mm-hmm. And so there are women in this community, be it Cote, Christy Puckett-Williams, who do work with offenders of domestic violence. And so one of the things you look at is somebody has had a choking incident, they are at a high risk of committing violence towards that person they've choked, as well as other people in the community.
You brought up a litany of things that young white males feel bad about themselves because they were told the world is their oyster, and it turns out you got to compete with everybody else in the world. That includes women and others, not like you. And it's called by some professionals white male grievance culture. Never heard that until yesterday, but I've read about it from a number of different people. It's what criminal justice professionals describe as the intersection of white entitlement, middle-class instability, and heterosexual masculinity. These are people who have failed throughout their lives in different ways, who were bullied or picked on, and this is an alternate route to achieving masculinity by committing a mass act of violence. That describes a lot of people who don't pick up a gun and commit a mass act of violence. So when we come back, I want to find out from the three of you what the difference is. Why do some people take it out on everybody and others just suck it up? We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHG. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the intersection of gun violence and mental illness and the tenuous relationship between the two, which is very limited in according to those in professional psychological circles. Dr. Sharif Solomon is a forensic psychologist at Atrium Health, Kathy Rogers, Executive Director of Mental Health America of the Central Carolinas, and Justin Perry, owner and therapist at Perry Counseling, Healing, and Recovery. We've talked a little bit about white male grievance culture and what leads young men to feel badly about themselves in the 21st century world in which we live, where they no longer have hegemony over everything and everybody. And that leads them to be unhappy with themselves and others and leads some of them, not all of them, to mass shooting incidents. Why some and not all? Why can some of us handle it and others can't?
Why can some of us drink alcohol and not become addicted and some of us can't?
But the gulf in the difference between those who do those things, those mass shootings, and those who don't is enormous.
Well, I mean, I think you could say that about dying from suicide and everything else as well. There's a continuum. Like, there's always a continuum in any illness, you know. So if you're using that, but anytime we're talking about a public health challenge, there's always going to be this continuum. And so to me, I think you're looking at multiple things. So we have all these terms like self-made man, rugged individual, all of these self-reliance, mm-hmm. and nobody gets socialized with that more and embraces that more than white males, which again works well in the business world and everything else. But the challenge is it often leaves you isolated. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these killings are rooted in disconnection. And so I always talk about we've got to stop forcing kids to be independent and teach them interdependence. So again, yes, we want people to stand on their own 2 feet, but they also have to understand they stand within a community. And unfortunately, a lot of the white males are so disconnected and isolated that when they have these problems, they don't have any other outlet.
And give them permission to feel something other than anger?
Absolutely.
How do you do that? How do you? Because if you feel sad and you cry and you're a man or you're a 16-year-old boy, mm-hmm. that's shameful.
Sure. And so it's our job to change that. We've got to start early giving our kids. So we got to give boys, and this is all boys across the board, but, you know, we're talking about white boys as well. But across the board, we've got to give them a full menu of emotions. It is okay to be sad. It's okay to be scared. It's okay to be confused. It's all of these things that we all wrap it up in this one thing called anger. And when I run men's groups, one of the things I often will tell the men is when we talk about how you're feeling about something, you can't say pissed off. Because that's pretty much the only emotion that's uncomfortable that we're allowed to say. We can talk about being happy and excited, but if you don't feel good, then I'm pissed off. And so we've got to go into what's underneath that. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why, like, to me, I'm not vilifying folks who get to this point. I'm saying we as a society have to shift the paradigm that is not the same. It's not the 50s anymore. And now there are, again, white men are still dominating our society. But at the same time, it feels like a threat, you know, and people respond to feelings more than they respond to thoughts.
And I think that's a lot where a lot of our political dialogue has reached an impasse, because something is shifting under our feet. We can't control it. It scares us and it makes us angry about things.
No, I was just going to add to Justin's list that men should feel okay asking for help.
Absolutely.
Amy Barnhorst, writing in Psychology Today, says, this is a quote, "Most of the time, mass shooters aren't driven by delusions or voices in their head. They are driven by a need to wield power mm-hmm. over another group. They are angry at the perceived injustices that have befallen them at the hands of others, women who wouldn't sleep with them, fellow students who didn't appreciate their talents, minorities enjoying rights that were once only the privilege of white men like them. It is not an altered perception of reality that drives them. It's entitlement, insecurity, and hatred." That makes this all the more disturbing to me, because how do you treat for that?
Well, in many of these cases where there is not mental illness, that's why we have a misplaced focus on mental illness. There are, when you're dealing with certain personality traits, some who wish to improve their function or improve their coping skills can benefit from psychotherapy. But again, I would like to see the discussion broaden from white males to more, you know, human experiences mm-hmm. that are universal. Sure, there are some of the grievances.
It's generally white males who commit these mass shootings.
Sure. No question about that. However, many of the emotions involved are universal and not necessarily unique to white males, because mass shootings, even though it doesn't feel like it, because of coverage of mass shootings as opposed to coverage of, say, violence in inner cities, it doesn't feel like it, but mass shootings are actually a fairly small proportion
right.
of gun violence and an even smaller proportion of all violence. And there are many grievances, some of which are rooted in relations between racial and political, religious groups and other groups. And some are intensely personal, such as a relationship that has gone badly or being fired from a job.
Mm-hmm. Juan emails something that is others have talked about that is kind of on the topic and kind of off the topic here. But the perpetrator in mass shootings, he says, is usually a white male portrayed as a victim, a lone wolf that didn't fit in. However, when a crime is committed by a brown or black person, we are seen as criminals. Mm-hmm. Or if the suspect is Middle Eastern, he is automatically a terrorist. White perpetrators suffer from mental health issues while non-whites are viewed as criminals or terrorists. What about that?
That goes into my, I have a rule of T's, Mike. Like if I hear that a violent incident like this has happened, I can tell by, if there are three T's that are mentioned, I can already tell the race of the person. So if it was a terrorist, there's someone of, you know, Islamic faith or Arab descent. If they're a thug, then they're black. If they're troubled, then they're white. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, it goes back into the empathy, who we tend to have empathy for. And so for me, I actually work to have empathy across the board. And I think on some level, some of these things are universal across race. That's why I said this is a man issue. But then there are the unique pieces within this culture that ties into this. And that's why when I asked you about how do we perceive the violence of the homicides in our community and everything right. else, it doesn't go to that kind of place. Because, again, we have a hard time imagining it happening this way. I want to say one more thing about that entitlement piece. There's this group of folks called incels, involuntary celibate. In other words, we talk about being rejected by women.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, but they create their own communities and their own chat rooms and everything else, and there's all kinds of toxic energy that comes in those spaces. And so it goes back to the belonging thing again. If we don't teach people healthy ways to belong in conventional ways, they'll find unhealthy ways, whether it's those groups, whether it's hate groups, whether it's gangs. It's the same thing.
When you're already isolated and you're already feeling negative thoughts about yourself and others, and you find your way into a chat room designed for people just like you, it seems to me that that would amplify those feelings because it becomes an echo chamber. And that leads us to social media, which is showing people on a regular basis that the other person on the other end of that social media, their life is always better than yours. They're only showing pictures of them on Instagram on vacation or at a great dinner, which may have lasted for 5 minutes and they didn't pay for it, but they're showing it to you and you're thinking, well, they're living a much better life than I am, which depresses you. And there has been a rise in depression. Mm-hmm. There's been a rise in anxiety among young people, men and women, correct?
I believe we have a human connection deficit in our country right now. And social media gives a false sense that we're connected, that we have friends. And what you mentioned about gangs, if I'm looking for something where I can feel like I belong, it could be a gang or one of these chat rooms. But we're finding, it's not human connection, but we're finding a connection that's not based in reality, really.
Right.
And
it's
we're
not
hearing
human.
One view. And certainly I tell I have two daughters that, and social media can sometimes be like the annual Christmas letter where you just hear, you know, the best that happened. You don't see all the other non-pretty things.
And it's not a conversation.
Media.
It is
exactly.
not a conversation.
Exactly.
And that's different. There's no human connection at all, really, but that you think there is because there's a person on the other end of that phone.
Right. Can I say something really quickly? Just,
sure.
Just tech with that. Even what we're doing with kids now. Kids' language is supposed to be play, but
right.
we force kids into technology and hard learning so early. So, again, all of this social-emotional development, we call them soft skills, but we need to stop calling them that because that's the root of what we're talking about. That's the root of why I have a job, frankly. You know, it's not a soft skill to be able to have a healthy relationship with somebody else. It's mm-hmm. got to be a fundamental part of child development and human development.
Mm-hmm. And those, just really quickly, those skills that Justin's discussing are more linked with success in the future than many of the so-called hard academics, especially early on.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of these young men who commit these mass shootings are described as loners, which tells you that they don't have a lot of friends, they don't have a lot of social contacts outside of these chat rooms that they might or might not find their way into.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, they're not really talking to real live people who can talk them off the ledge. They're in this echo chamber. So if most of these people who commit these violent acts are loners, how many of them out there could there be that we don't have any idea they're in existence because they are loners?
unfortunately many. However, the slight sort of glimmer of hope is that in studies, the vast majority of people who threaten violence, especially serious violence such as mass shootings, do not go through with it or do not actually commit acts of violence. The studies almost universally agree that when we assess someone as being high risk for violence, even there, they're unlikely to actually be violent.
Yeah.
So we tend to err on the side of caution and tend to, I think, to some degree, overcall violence risk.
I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it because Steve on Facebook has asked it. What role does fatherlessness play in all of this? Nearly all of the mass shooters came from homes without fathers. What role does a father play in helping a young man learn to successfully navigate the negative experiences he encounters in life? I'm not sure who to throw that question to.
So one, I'll say I can't verify in terms of the fatherlessness stat, but mm-hmm. what I can say is that even within that, I think when we talk about fatherhood, we even have to talk about what that looks like. Because again, sometimes, again, most of these folks are not poor or anything like that. A lot of folks are actually coming from middle and upper middle class homes, and so they may even have their father there, but also you may have a father who's constantly on business and everything else. And so, again, going to that disconnection piece, sometimes people think of, well, father's just somebody who's just gone, whether they're incarcerated or whatever else. But a lot of times we have fathers who technically are married and there, but just are not present. And so I think we have to look at it as a quality thing as well as a quantity thing.
Following the most recent shootings, the president seemed to be shifting course. He called for more stronger, effective background checks, and then almost immediately over the course of a weekend shifted his focus back to mental health, even though mental health is they say that 95% to 97%, as you said, of gun violence is not caused by people who suffer from a mental illness. And then the president called the shooter in El Paso, the shooters in El Paso and Dayton, another twisted monster,
yes,
and a wicked man. In the past, he's used the term sicko, a savage sicko, to describe a mass shooter. What's the impact of that?
This really concerns me, that the language that we use in the media and coming from our leaders at the very top, talking about institutionalizing. It makes me think we're moving back to a time that we never would dream we'd be moving to, where people were in shackles in an institution. And I believe it further will keep those people who need to get help from getting help.
Well, he's
right. Just not healthy.
He is right when he says we need more mental health treatment. And he's right when he dates it back to the Reagan administration, when a lot of people were released from mental institutions for many different reasons, not the least of which is it's cheaper to have them be on the street by themselves and be homeless. Your organization, Kathy, advocates for bringing copays for treatment of mental health care more in line with lower copays for physical health care. I didn't know they were higher. They're higher?
Yes. We need to treat mental health like we treat physical health.
Why don't we?
That's a good...
Well, in theory, we are supposed to. There are parity laws on the books, but there are a variety of reasons, I think. I'm not a policy expert, but I think certainly stigma is part of it. Cost is part of it. There are a lot of factors.
But if there's not a connection to health care and violence, health care and shootings, health care and mass shootings, health care and black-on-black shootings, health care on domestic violence, if there's no connection between that, how will greater access to health care reduce the problem?
But it's a human problem. I mean, if I have cancer, I'm going to go get treatment for my cancer. I hope I'm answering this right. If I have a mental health diagnosis, schizophrenia, or I want to live a good life and have a good, be able to work.
I guess what I'm asking here is, the president advocates for better health care. Good idea. But that's not going to solve the problem of mass shootings, because there's no connection or a limited connection. Is that right?
I guess even so, the elephant in the room we haven't talked about is
very
that
quickly.
We're conflating two different issues, because we don't want to talk about the actual issue of restricting gun access. So we do need increased access to mental health care, but this is not the reason
why. And you get the last word. Justin Perry, owner, therapist, Perry Counseling, Healing, and Recovery. Kathy Rogers, Executive Director of Mental Health America of the Central Carolinas. And Dr. Sharif Solomon, forensic psychiatrist with Atrium Health. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.